Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. That debt is fraud. It's now or never. And we are scratching our heads trying to figure out what we need to do to get you involved, folks, because nothing. We cannot restore. I mean, if you're happy with conservative things, then you're going to be happy with non-compliance to the Constitution as long as there's just we got a quasi-moral government basically running tyranny and ruckshod over us. So I'm hoping that people can get beyond their little paradigms of conservatism. We have to demand full compliance with the Constitution or we'll never have the rule of law. Never. And so, with that, I hope you're with us in discovering what we have to do, because most of you should probably know by now. And again, that's why we need to scratch our heads and go, what's it going to take? Because it's all about full compliance with the Constitution. Again, please, if you're open to helping and supporting a champion of the Constitution, go connect with Jerry Wistrand. His contact information is on our candidate endorsement page, ReclaimingTheRepublic.org candidate endorsement page. You can click right to his domain. I think we even have a direct link to his donations. But by all means, do everything you can to support him with whatever you can. He needs the help. I talk to him on a weekly basis. He needs the help. Period. Gas isn't cheap, and there's lots of people, a lot of meetings, lots of opportunities that hopefully are not going to waste. Anyway, with that, we were just going to dive into Mr. Barnwell's comments. And I know that Sean, welcome back, Sean. Sean made a comment. He goes, David Ramsey, he was there. And so you're actually going to notice, and I honestly think Dave Ramsey is a doctor, right? Does he have a doctorate degree in finance or whatever?
So, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you're going to see, that's one name, and there's another one. I think it's James Clymer of Pennsylvania. Today, the former president or chair, the former chair of the Constitution Party was James Clymer. He just stepped down a couple of years ago. And so, yeah, you'll see that there's names. If I remember correctly, doesn't Dave Ramsey kind of have a Southern accent?
Yes, sir. I'm not sure where he's from. I'm trying to remember what he says all the time.
But I do know.
Might be from Florida.
Okay. I do know, you know, it's always not the families can't move, right? I do know James Clymer of Pennsylvania in the convention, of the Pennsylvania convention, and James Clymer of the Constitution Party. They both live in Pennsylvania, and I believe they're both lawyers, because I know the current one is. So anyway, anywho. The irony or that's kind of interesting. Can't not notice. Anyway, let's go ahead and get back into what you just started before the last show ended. Go ahead.
Mr. Barnwell continued to say, I now come to the last point for consideration. I mean the clause relative to the Negroes. And here I am particularly pleased with the Constitution. It has not left this matter of so much importance to us open to immediate investigation. No, it has declared that the United States shall not at any rate consider this matter for 21 years, and yet gentlemen are displeased with it. Congress has guaranteed this right for that space of time, and at its expiration may continue it as long as they please. This question then arises, what will their interests lead them to do? The Eastern states, as the honorable gentleman says, will become the carriers of America. It will, therefore, certainly be their interest to encourage exportation to as great an extent as possible, and if the quantum of our products will be diminished by the prohibition of Negroes, I appeal to the belief of every man, whether he thinks those very carriers will themselves dam up the sources from whence their profit is derived. To think so is so contradictory to the general conduct of mankind, that I am of opinion that without we ourselves put a stop to them, the traffic for Negroes will continue forever. Mr. Barnwell concluded by declaring that this Constitution was, in his opinion, like the laws of Solon, not the best possible to be formed, but the best that our situation will admit of. He considered it as the panacea of America, whose healing power will pervade the continent, and sincerely believed that its ratification is a consummation devoutly to be wished.
Interesting, now, isn't that interesting? Go ahead. Are you there?
I'm done.
Okay, I'm sorry about the phone. I should have put it away. So, isn't that interesting? In other words,
yes, it is quite interesting because he seems to have forward thinking, but his forward thinking doesn't have anything to do with what's going to happen as things continue and the slavery continues. It's still going to have the same problems that it always had. So when they finish doing the swamps in South Carolina, what happens then?
Actually, this goes back to what I said. When people are manipulative and they start dealing with other people, they accuse them of being manipulative because that's how they see the world, right? And so this man sees the world as money-grubbing capitalists, that profit is going to dictate over morals and over what is absolutely right. Right? What, you know, over spirituality and, you know, the love of one, love of mankind and love of one another. So I see this, and what we're doing was, in a way, we're looking at these men's souls.
For sure.
And so, because he sees this as, who can go against what is good business? Now, you hear me talk about business decisions, right? The worst business decision made ever, King George. So I can put things into that context. But when you completely disregard something of a moral nature, that business will prevail in that. Oh, my. Oh, my. How we tend to lose our way. So, let's keep going. And the next comment.
Another thing that struck me, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Another thing that strikes me is that where is the spirit of liberty that on the one hand is driving this whole evolution of our government and our nation? And why can't they apply that to the people that they have in bondage and see for themselves that eventually these people are going to have enough of this?
Right.
You know, and how can you say, oh, well, governments, legitimate governments, come from the consent of the governed and the will of the people, right?
Right.
Well, what about these people? You think they don't think the same way that you do? And what happened to that indomitable spirit of liberty when you're talking about slaves? Well, the profit outweighs it, like you were saying.
Right. Okay, so down a little bit further here, there's the Honorable Arthur Simpkins. And he basically says, and this is how it's been captured, because it was really something that was kind of just bubbled up and glossed over at the same time. Because, and you'll see what I mean by this, because the comment is, of 96 asked for information whether Congress had a right to interfere in religion. I have no idea of what that is. There's nothing missing here. It's just that this is what they threw in, because then there was this reply that Charles Cotesworth Pinckney answered that they had no power at all, and explained this point to Mr. Simpson's satisfaction, done. So this all of a sudden there was this bubble up that Simpkins was kind of turning into a Karen. Hey, you know, I need information. They were going to have the right to interfere with religion. And then Coach was picking, he just said, calm down, get your britches out of your butt, kind of thing. Anyway, forgive the French, folks, forgive the French. Or the vernacular I use. For lack of better terms, hopefully that all makes sense. I'm just trying to be curt and to the point. But now we're going to get back into Charles Coatsworth Pinckney again, a little bit further down. And he's going to expound more upon the enumerated powers. Let's go ahead.
The general then, in answer to Mr. Lowndes' objection that the powers vested in the general government were too extensive, enumerated all the powers granted, and remarked particularly on each, showing that the general good of the Union required that all the powers specified ought necessarily to be vested where the Constitution had placed them, and that as all the powers granted sprang from the people and were to be exercised by persons frequently chosen, mediately or immediately by the people, and that as we had as great a share in the government in proportion to our importance as any other state had, the assertion that our representation would be merely virtual, similar to what we possessed under the British government, was altogether unfounded, and that there was no danger of the powers granted being abused while the people remained uncorrupt, and that corruption was more effectually guarded against in the manner this government was constituted than in any other that had ever been formed.
Okay. So, jumping down a little, again, we're going to be finding these exact same comments, just phrased differently, about, hey, if it's not enumerated, they can't do it. So let's go down a little bit further where he talks about the uniformity and commerce. Go ahead.
I have spoken before of the policy and justice of vesting the majority of Congress with the power of making commercial regulations, and the necessity there is in an all well-constituted republics that the majority should control the minority. And I should have had a very strong objection if it had contained the restrictive clause the honorable gentleman appears so anxious for, quote, that Congress should not have it in their power to prevent the ships of any nation from entering our ports, end quote. I cannot think it would have been prudent or fitting to have given the ships of all foreign nations a constitutional right to enter our ports whenever they please, and this, too, notwithstanding we might be at war with them, or they may have passed laws denying us the privileges they grant to all other commercial nations, or circumstances not now foreseen might render it necessary for us to prohibit them. Such a clause would have injured the eastern states, would have been eventually detrimental to ourselves, and would have in fact amounted to a declaration that we were resolved never to have a navy.
Okay, so the way I see this lack of thought, and I don't think he mentions who made this comment, that Congress should not have it in their power to prevent the ships of any nation from entering into our ports. But you can see the way this is strictly speculation or deduction, that his concern was that if Congress, going down the road, becomes more hostile towards slave trade and so forth, that if they could actually not have any power to stop any ship from coming into their ports, that's how they could backdoor and be able to do end runs around what they could do or what they couldn't do, like the importation of slaves. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Okay. I think you're probably right.
Yeah. So
your speculation is extremely likely.
Yeah. All right. So a little bit further down, then he makes this other comment. The general government could not abuse the power. Okay.
The general government could not abuse this power and favor one state and oppress another, as each state was to be taxed only in proportion to its representation. And as to excises, when it is considered how many more excisable articles are manufactured to the northward than there are to the southward, and the ease and convenience of raising a revenue by indirect taxation, and the necessity there is to obtain money for the payment of our debts, for our common defense, and for the general welfare, he thought every man would see the propriety and even necessity of this clause.
Okay, so the interesting thing is that, and it didn't come out as well as I was hoping, when it kind of brushed with the word uniformity, but it didn't really highlight that. Because the Constitution is clear that all taxes must be uniform. What that means, folks, is burdens placed upon the states by the federal government must be uniform. Each state must equally suffer in pain per capita. And that's how they base it down, is by people, not by land mass, not by, you know, resources, but by the heads of the people. How many people do you have? And then the calculation would go and apply. So if the burden is one, you know, a dollar a head, then based on how many heads, that's how much your state is going to bear. The uniformity clause forbids it for being arbitrary or not equal. And when we talk about this, and I want to bring this in, you know, in an oblique manner, not sideways, but kind of sideways moving forward, that when the federal government started creating burdens on land and resources of states as they started moving westward, how is that not a tax? Because now that land is no longer going to be available for people within that state to cultivate, to basically work, to be able to extrapolate resources, minerals, what have you, to mine and create products and exportations and so forth so that they could make money. See the point?
Yes, sir.
That they had the ability to tax, but they couldn't create burdens or favoritisms, which kind of goes back to how that first part that you read stated. I had spoken before of the policy and justice of vesting the majority of Congress in the power of making commercial regulations and the necessity, maybe it was in the one before that, that they couldn't give privileges to one state or one port over another. I believe maybe it was the one before that, where he actually talked about they couldn't create advantages, you know, or disadvantages for one state, for one port, or anything like that. And so how is it not, when you actually take away the trees from a state, how is that not a disadvantage? Oh, well, nobody's going to be buying their trees, so everybody's going to be buying trees from these guys. So forth and so on. So anyway, let's go back down a little further. Actually, I think the next one is the Navy. Let's go ahead and dive into that one.
It was urged that until we had a Navy powerful enough to protect us, our liberties and property were held only on courtesy. But if gentlemen adverted where this Navy so necessary was to come from, not from the southern states, but from the northern ones, they would easily perceive to whom this country would belong. It was true, the old Confederation was a mere paper defense, but then it was a good proof on our behalf if we were overcome by unmerited wrongs. Some had made this a question, quote, will you join or will you be single? For his part, he did not think matters had come to such a crisis. Rather, let us comply with our federal connection, which, not yet being broken, admits of being strengthened. A gentleman had instanced Fattel in support of his argument, and laid down from that author an opinion that where parties engaged in the performance of an obligation, should any one of them fly off from his agreement, the original was null and void.
So that's a comment that talks about when, you know, when things are being agreed to, you can't walk out of a contract. But when the contract is being violated, when somebody's violating it, or when the subordinate or the subcontractor is violating the contract, then that opens the door for a state and for a group or what have you to say, we're out of here. Now, let me ask you this. When we look at what's going on today, and all of a sudden, we see these things such as, Washington State not liking the infliction and the compliance to the Constitution is unfavorable. They don't like it. They don't want to comply to the Constitution. They would not have the privilege of being able to step away because it's not, the contract is not being violated. It's finally being enforced. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So the people, there's a lot of people that think, oh, well, all of a sudden, you know, when things start going right, you know, we could just, you know, sever in the Civil War. No, not so. We could right now sever asunder as a nation and be fragmented in so many different ways because of the noncompliance. Bring compliance back. It galvanizes and forces us back together. You can't walk away once we're starting to comply, once the rule of law is being followed. So just to help everybody understand that, you know, you can start stepping in and cleaning house big time if California, the way California is functioning and operating outside the bounds of the Constitution, boom. As we start demanding compliance, we actually have the power and authority to go in and hold them accountable. They can't walk away or they can't start doing things their own way. We're all held to that standard. We're all supposed to be holding each other to that standard. Okay, so let's dive into the next one, which is enumerated by Mr. Charles Coatsworth Pinckney. Go ahead.
Can I have a comment real quick?
Sure, go ahead, yeah.
Are you saying that it seems to me that there's a fine line between nullification and insurrection, according to the 14th Amendment?
So nullification is expunging a law that is incompatible with the supreme law of the land.
I might be using the wrong terms, but that was kind of the idea that I was thinking when you were talking about if Washington decides that they don't want to go along with the Constitution.
Uh-huh, and right.
Like you were talking about, if they've already agreed to the contract and the contract isn't being violated or you're correcting the terms, right, like you're talking about, I think that's what you're getting at, is Republic review and constitutional compliance. If they say, oh, we don't want to comply with the Constitution, that's not an option. That would be insurrection.
Uh-huh.
According to the 14th Amendment.
Yes. Okay. So when the federal government is running and conducting an insurrection against the Constitution, such as bringing in refugees, such as basically bringing in over the past few decades illegals, such as basically printing money and putting it into the hands of people to be non-productive, such as subsidies for farmers, subsidies for corporations, on and on and on and on and on and on and on, right? So the federal government has actually been running an insurrection because you're right. It is an insurrection when any government body, federal, state, county, is conducting business with is in violation to the Constitution. When we start demanding compliance and say we can't do those things, that is, you know, that's a violation, then those people who demand to be able to continue violating stand in full jeopardy of being removed and banned. And not only that, but you know what, because we're going into break, I'll wait, because I don't want to break it up. I'll just pick it up from where we started off with when we come back from break, because we're at the cusp of something that is much bigger than just banning somebody from public service. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so any public servant, any group of public servants, any body of government that is operating in a way or conducting business, receiving money, I mean, there's so many different ways of violating the Constitution. In other words, taking money from Congress, that Congress can't spend that money. They're giving the state money to do something, basically like coercing the state. Congress has no authority. In other words, Congress is running an insurrection. Anytime that there is something that is directly violating the Constitution, it is an insurrection. Now, one of the things I want to place context to, because when we look at the Alien Sedition Acts, the way Thomas Jefferson and James Madison basically stated when they called on the states to join together, and you tell me if I'm wrong, it was almost like the end of the world. I mean, they were basically saying that we just cannot allow this because it's all over if this happens, right? Remember that? It's kind of, you know, that level of extremity was being communicated in those resolutions.
Yes, right? Sir.
Okay. So if that's the case, then I'm here to tell you that that insurrection that they're dealing with was, in their eyes, that significant. However, in the magnitude and the resilience of the Constitution, it really wasn't the end of the Constitution. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if the Constitution is going to be completely ran over and done with by this one or all of the series, because folks, look today. Is the Constitution done? Is it shredded and gone? Do we not have the Constitution anymore? Well, we have so much government we're not supposed to have, but that doesn't mean we don't have the Constitution and can't get back into full compliance of the Constitution. What I am saying here is that this Constitution is so divine that it has this level of resilience. The thing that would create the demise of the Constitution is when the parties turn their back, when basically the federal government comes along and says, we are no longer going to follow the Constitution. And the states basically say, okay, that's what you say. We're whatever you need, whatever you want to do, we're behind you. Everything up to this point, they've done things that were violations, and instead of saying we're dismantling the Constitution, they said we need to do this. We need to take on this debt. We need to go into bankruptcy. We need to do this, blah, blah, blah. They've never once said the Constitution's dead. Never once. Which means that the states still have the ability to stand up and say, you know what? We still have this Constitution. It is still our governing document, and we are now demanding full compliance to it. You see the point?
Oh, absolutely. And I believe from the thing that you taught me is even if the states were to say, oh, well, okay, we're not going to go to bed, they don't have the right to do that because they were formed by the people. And if they don't have the will of the people to end the Constitution, then that's fraudulent.
Well, so you're right. You're right. But because they're the parties to it, getting back from them doing that will be very hard. I mean, this is where we would literally be forced to, take over our states. I mean, this would be not a revolution, because, folks, the beautiful thing is to get our government back into compliance, all we have to do is apply the necessary political force, not deadly force, but the political force to say you're gone. You're no longer in office. We're not electing you. In other words, we, the people, all have to agree. And you just need enough of the people throughout the state to start cleaning it up. It does not require a mass majority. It does not require the firing of a gun. What we have in this Constitution is so beautiful. It's called the rule of law and accountability. And believe it or not, the 14th Amendment is that one pivotal punctuation that gives us all the power we need. As we look at everything that's being done by the states differently, by the federal government and so forth, it is chaos. Madison even said this could continue on to such a chaotic point that, you know, there may not ever be a restoration. I don't think Madison was fathoming to the level of where we are today. But there's no doubt in my mind that that man standing, probably looking down from heaven and saying, wow, I didn't see such a resilience in this Constitution that this republic could actually arise from this and actually become even greater than what we created. People in my family call me the forever optimist. Yeah, because I can always see the positive side of things. And some people that know me and hear me sometimes, you know, like from the Marine Corps over, I can always put the negative and I can always complain. You know, that's one thing you learn in the military, because, you know, when you're going through inspections, what are you doing? You're not looking to, you know, you're not going out of your way to compliment. Hey, thanks for showing up. No, when you're inspecting, when you're, you know, in command of your, you know, your Marines, your troops, whatever, and you're following them in and you're looking at them, you're looking for faults. You're looking for problems so that you can pick them down and say, you didn't do enough. You didn't iron very good today. Huh? Look at this Irish pennant. Look at these, you know, creases in your trousers. All these different little things that you can gig them on. You know what I'm saying, Sean?
Absolutely.
And so you that becomes a part of you professionally, to finding fault and to being good at that. But I think it's equally important, because we can't not. I mean, if you want the best product possible, that's a product that's flawless. And so that's what you're trying to do in making flawless Marines, or Marines that are, you know, being so thorough in everything that they do that, you know, you can't find fault. You want to get everybody to that point. It's almost like, in a way, our charge would be kind of like Enoch in creating such a righteous city that it would be translated, or having such, you know, perfect Marines that they can do no harm or what have you, or whatever. But to get them there, you have to, you know, point out the flaws, if you ignore the flaws, then they'll never get fixed. So anyway, I'm just showing you that, you know, there's this two-sided, you know, not a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde conflict, but there's this two sides that people would see if they were really looking at me. Now, on my family side, the family members are always telling me, oh, you're always the optimist. Come on now, let's be pragmatic here. And then in the Marine Corps side, or engineering and other work, people just hated it because I was always finding the flaws. Anyway, you just learn to do those things. But the point here is that this Constitution has the resiliency of being able to snap back. And it would not take long, folks, if you started right now with your counties, and because it would just take a couple of election processes or what have you. Once we start, it can't stop. Once we get the people woken up and demanding and thirsty for full compliance and the rule of law, it does it. This is a non-stoppable change. This is something that would go forward like the Reformation of Christianity under Martin Luther, because the people, the spirit would be with us, and people would want this. They'd be hungry for it. Anyway, so as we look at the insurrections, those who were insurrecting would be purged. And as I was going into break, this is what I wanted to say. There is the 14th Amendment basically states that you cannot serve if you're in office and you're failing to support the Constitution, which means you're violating your oath. You're gone. You can no longer serve. I will say even greater than that. The people have a right. If you have failed that badly and or you continue to fail, whether you're a public servant or even a citizen and failing to support the Constitution and failing to get on board, we may get to a point where we may actually start, I don't want to say wholesale stripping of citizenship, but those who are leading in insurrections, you know, vocally or what have you, say, we need to revolt, we need to do this. We see them. These are cheerleaders. We saw them in Congress in 2020. We saw Congress basically saying, get out there and revolt. Get out there and basically do an insurrection in the streets. Protesting in the streets is the same thing as insurrection. You do not have a right to protest in the streets. You don't like your government? Then it is your job to get a petition, formulate your petition of how this, whatever's happening, is violating the Constitution, create that argument, and stand in front of your representatives and petition them. The problem is that communists who want to overthrow the Constitution can't formulate a constitutional argument of how their rights are being violated. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
I mean,
that's exactly what's going on.
There is no argument that can support, we have a right to destroy this and create a communist government and, you know, and stealing from those who have and giving to those who have not. That's what we want to, you know, you can't, that's not a constitutional argument. That's an insurrectionist argument. And people that want to lead on those types of things would be stripped of their citizenship. If we actually, if we were thinking clearly, that's what would happen. And folks, this is not just something out of, you know, my back pocket. See, I got that, you know, that was kind of clean. So this isn't something I'm pulling out of my back pocket. This is something that is in our history. The Tory Acts expelled people, folks. These were British loyalists who they said, we can't keep these loyalists among us. They're our enemies. I'm telling you, the communists and the Mohammedans, they're our enemies. They're not going to stay here and just roll over. They're going to start organizing. They'll take up arms. When they start realizing what we can do to them and get rid of them, then they're going to try to, you know, inflict pain and fury upon us. Does that make sense?
It's already happening.
It is happening, but it's not to the degree where they're in an onslaught, where they're actually, you know, marching down streets, burning, you know, our homes and that type of thing.
They're still in this subversive stage.
Yes, correct. Because we haven't gotten to a point where we're saying, you keep doing this and we're deporting you, you're gone, we're taking everything from you. Because, folks, when we deport them, we can strip them of everything. Their citizenship, the right to be here, as well as their property. They're no longer citizens. Regardless of what the Supreme Court says, your privileges and protection of property, due process, all of these privileges that are granted as civil rights in this country are only afforded to citizens. That's why the 14th Amendment, again, you know, this beautiful amendment says no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of a U.S. citizen. But we can clearly make laws that abridge the privileges and immunities of people who have been stripped of their citizenship, who are running insurrections against us. I don't think, you know, I've made these arguments before, but I'm hoping that this is about as clear and as probably intended that you can see precisely what we have the ability to do here. It's in our hands. It's in the citizens' hands. This is our government. We have to demand it. We have to stand up and say, no more. You're not just making it up as you go along. You're no longer compromising. We're going to start removing citizenship if necessary. And then when people start seeing their citizenship stripped, guess what? This was when they start going underground. There are some of these people will go underground, and then when we find them and they actually go out because they want to maintain their citizenship and they continue running an insurrection, then we got to hang them on treason, because the next step is actually going to that point. Because people need to get the message, we don't have to tolerate your crap. We don't have to tolerate it. You have a right to go anywhere and do that crap if you can get away with it. But you can't. We're not letting you get away with it here anymore. Hopefully that makes sense.
There's some recent news. I don't know if you saw it. It was on June 8th. The DOJ announced civil denaturalization complaints against 17 people. And this year they've had over 300.
Yeah, I have seen that. But that's still only bad actors. Bottom line.
Right, correct.
Bottom line, what should be coming out of the DOJ, what should be coming out of the Trump administration is, if you are an invader, and actually I heard in the last couple of days, they've kind of alluded to that. If you have been here for less than 2 years, they're getting a little closer, because the last I heard was, if you've been here for less than 2 years and we pick you up, we're deporting you. I say, it doesn't matter how long you've been here. There is nothing in the law that creates a statute of limitations that says, hey, if you've been here illegally all your life, then, you know, or for 20 years, that's not a law. There is no protection. You are here illegally. You are an invader. The Constitution, you have to amend the Constitution, folks, to be able to do that, by the way. In other words, Congress can't just make a law that says, if you're an invader and you've been here for 20 years, then you can become a citizen. Now, they may be able to say, oh, well, under the auspices of, to, you know, Congress should have the power to make a uniform rule of naturalization, that's, they're going to do that way. But technically, no, they would actually have to amend the language that says Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia, to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections, and to repel invaders. Because they would have to then classify that clause, invaders that have been here or been present in the United States for greater than 20 years, then they don't go. They'd actually have to amend that, because if you're an invader, you have to be repelled. Constitution demands the repelling of an invader.
And that would be anyone who comes into the country without authorization, correct?
That is correct. If you've come in without prior authorization from a state, technically the Constitution demands that a state says, yes, we will allow you to come to our state. Doesn't mean you can come into the United States. That means that you have to have secured transportation to get your butt to the state of Oregon. And that's it. If you're coming from Mexico, you might as well come up by boat. Or you actually have to secure some form of transportation so that when you get to the port of entry, like Portland, Oregon International Airport, and you have your visa, you have your little comment card right there that says, hey, I've been accepted to come here to initiate my immigration process to become a United States citizen. Because that's what's put you on the path. Now, if you're coming across the Mexican border, I believe that a minimum, you know, because we don't have, we've never secured this properly. The federal government has assumed the power, and they just said, you know, we don't care what you're going to do. We're going to do it for you. The states actually need to step in and say, hey, and as a matter of fact, these progressive states can't get away with saying, well, we're going to allow these bad actors to come in as immigrants then. They can't do it, because you have enough good states to actually say, no, we're not allowing those types of players, because that's how the banishment of Islam was applied by all the other states. As long as a state bans a specific group of people, such as a religion or what have you, and those things were honored for well over a century, people of that religion could never become a citizen. They may be able to travel on diplomatic purposes, commercial purposes, but never as an immigrant. They were not allowed to come as immigrants because banishments, or I should say bans on them, were prevalent throughout the states. The only point of coming here is an immigrant, because once you become a U.S. citizen, you create these conflicts that now the citizen has a right to be able to go to and travel into any state, where these states have said, no, we're banning this. And you have to respect the sovereignty of the state of doing that. And so, folks, I just want you to understand that, you know, as we look at these problems, you know, I hope you start seeing how resilient this Constitution is, how these men really didn't see this. They just, you know, oh, it's all over. This is the straw that's going to break the camel's back. And they were wrong. Anyway, let's dive into what we were going to read. The general government has no powers, but go ahead.
The general government has no powers but what are expressly granted to it. It therefore has no power to take away the liberty of the press, that invaluable blessing which deserves all the encomiums the gentleman has justly bestowed upon it. Let me read that again. The general government had no powers but what are expressly granted to it. It therefore has no power to take away the liberty of the press, that invaluable blessing which deserves all the encomium the gentleman has justly bestowed upon it, is secured by all our state constitutions. And to have mentioned it in our general constitution would perhaps furnish an argument hereafter that the general government had a right to exercise powers not expressly delegated to it. For the same reason, we had no Bill of Rights inserted in our constitution, for as we might perhaps have omitted the enumeration of some of our rights, it might hereafter be said we had delegated to the general government a power to take away such of our rights as we had not enumerated. But by delegating express powers, we certainly reserve to ourselves every power and right not mentioned in the Constitution. Another reason weighed particularly with the members from this state against the insertion of a Bill of Rights. Such bills generally begin with declaring that all men are by nature born free. Now, we should make that declaration with a very bad grace, when a large part of our property consists in men who are actually born slaves. As to the clause guaranteeing to each state a Republican form of government being inserted near the end of the Constitution, the general observed that it was as binding as if it had been inserted in the first article. The Constitution takes its effect from the ratification, and every part of it is to be ratified at the same time, and not one clause before the other, but he thought there was peculiar propriety in inserting it where it was, as it was necessary to form the government before that government could guarantee anything.
Okay.
Very, very well said.
Very well said. Right. Absolutely. So...
Except for those encomiums.
Aren't you glad I actually inserted that
one? I am, because that one, yeah.
I know.
That's one we don't use anymore.
Yeah. So moving down again, Charles Pinckney. Now, this is Mr. Charles Pinckney, not Coatsworth. Okay? So talking about commerce here.
Right. Commerce. I do not agree with him so far as to suppose that commerce is generally cheating. I think that there are some kinds of commerce not only fair and valuable, but such as ought to be encouraged by government. I agree with him in this general principle that all the great objects of government should be subservient to the increase of agriculture and support of the landed interests, and that commerce should only be so far attended to as it may serve to improve and strengthen them. That the object of a republic is to render its citizens virtuous and happy, and that an unlimited foreign commerce can seldom fail to have a contrary tendency.
Okay. Now, he also goes on a little further down and talks about the differences of the state governments. Again, we're hearing this in almost every state so far, that they're noting that their government is not the same as all the rest of the governments, and that they're all different. There you go. Go ahead.
3 minutes.
All right.
In Pennsylvania and Georgia, the whole powers of government are lodged in a legislative body of a single branch, over which there is no control, nor are their executives or judiciaries from their connection and necessary dependence on the legislature capable of strictly executing their respective offices. In all the other states except Maryland, Massachusetts, and New York, they are only so far improved as to have a legislature with two branches, which completely involve and swallow up all the powers of their government. And neither of these are the judicial or executive place in that firm or independent situation which can alone secure the safety of the people or the just administration of the laws. In Maryland, one branch of the legislature is the Senate, chosen for 5 years by electors chosen by the people. The knowledge and firmness which this body have upon all occasions displayed not only in the exercise of their legislative duties, but in withstanding and defeating such of the projects of the other house as appear to them founded in local and personal motives, have long since convinced me that the Senate of Maryland is the best model of a Senate that has yet been offered to the Union, that is, it is capable of correcting many of the vices of the other parts of their Constitution, and in a great measure atoning for those defects which, in common with the states I have mentioned, are but too evident in their execution, the want of stability and independence in the judicial and executive departments.
Okay, so before you go further, we can stop here.
Right.
And I think there's a little bit to chew on, because here he's talking about these forms of government, and yet there's no one batting an eye as to whether these governments are Republican in form. Do you see my point? In other words, sir, is there one state saying, hey, you know, Delaware over here, or Pennsylvania, because he kind of mentions how, what is it at the very beginning, Pennsylvania, Georgia, I mean, these governments are large in a single legislative body of a single branch. Well, are they saying that that's not Republican in form, where the other ones have bicameral branches? Or where they have independent, or some have independent. My point is that not one person is saying that that's not Republican in form. No. Let me say that again, folks. Nobody can say that that's not Republican in form, that that form of government is not conducive to the requirement of a Republican form of government mandated in Article 4. So the point is this. When the Warren Court in the 1960s, based on one principle, or based on the principle one person, one vote, said you can't have these Republican forms of government anymore, when they don't even have the authority, and these states were well within their rights as a Republican form of government to be formed the way they were, where the Supreme Court reached out and basically dismantled and subverted each of these states into democracies. You cannot tell me that we don't have a problem. And the problem isn't the Constitution. The problem are our public servants. The problem are those and who they're doing the bidding for. That the Supreme Court has been more of, I'll just say, they have been more of an enemy of the Constitution for so long that it's just ridiculous. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.